welcome back to another exciting episode of Extra Featured Enemy. Today I have a fabulous guest who I'm very happy brought me a Christmas film, which I don't get to see enough of this time of year. Ryan Hendricks' new film, Lost His Christmas, I think it's available everywhere, but he'll tell me if I'm wrong. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me. Been looking forward to it. It's out there. It's in America and Canada. It's on multiple streaming platforms. It's readily available, and I'm think of it.
Let's start with the easiest question I can think of. Not everybody likes Christmas or writing for Christmas, because usually they're warm and happy films. And let's be honest, you don't really see too many sad Christmas films. So what brings you to a Christmas film? What's the warmth you look for in Christmas?
Well, I suppose we've gone and found the middle ground, really. I love Christmas. I love this time of year. I love that cold, crisp look. I love the markets. I love the lights. I love everything about it. I love Christmas movies. I love things like Home Alone and Miracle on 34th Street. And there's a really sort of unique warmth that comes with Christmas films that in any other time of the year, they would be relegated as just simply, quote unquote Hallmark. But I suppose they kind of live in the best of both worlds, really, I suppose. It's a unique time of year where you can tell a unique perspective on storytelling. And so that kind of got my interest. And I was thinking about things I wanted to do. And, you know, although in America it's not really a Christmas movie, but over here it is because we don't have Thanksgiving. Planes, Trains and Automobiles is my all-time favourite movies. Over here in the UK, it falls into, you know, turning up in the festive period. And I was kind of thinking about something like that and different things that I'm interested in. So I kind of ended up with this, you know, this travelling holiday film. And I'm a romantic at heart, so there was a definition of different themes about a love story. And I was just kind of partly what I was interested in, partly my my writing partner at the time had just gone through a really bad breakup and was having a really hard time with it. And I was on a train going from Glasgow to London, and I was thinking about all these different things, and I was thinking about what she was just going through as well, and it all kind of suddenly popped in my head. I've got an idea. So I phoned her up and said, I've got this idea. What do you think about, you know, playing fast and loose with the truth? She was right up for it and kind of thought it was quite cathartic to kind of help her move on as well. So from various different things in our lives at the time, and we ended up with what ended up being that short film.
Okay. So you have a writing partner. Now, do you find, because you're male, you like writing the male side of things? And because she's female, she writes the female kind of things? Or do you trade off?
It's a complete mix. I really like writing for female characters. And it's when I was younger, it was something that maybe I wasn't all that great at. And it's something I kind of spent a lot of time focusing on to try and make sure I got better at that. And what's ended up happening out of that is most of my work tends to have very strong female leads. And it's not a deliberate choice, as in, we've got to be moving with the times and do this. It's not about that at all. It's literally what's more interesting for the story. So I tend to think up more interesting stories for female characters before the male characters these days. But that's just my sort of creative preference. But we kind of have a bit of a trade-off. So Claire likes to sort of fret over every single detail. So I find the best way to do a script when you're working with somebody else, you've got to get the structure down. You've got to get the foundation of the thing on paper. And then you can polish back and forth. So it's all about kind of figuring out the beginning, middle, end, and going for it. I mean, I can think about stuff for ages and ages, but there'll come a point for me where switch just flips in my head, and it's like, okay, I'm ready to write. I've got the story, I've got the tone, let's go. And, you know, let the fingers do the work. And then, kind of, you know, sometimes you're way off the mark, but quite often we're kind of not far away from where we're trying to hit. And it's just, yeah, it's just about kind of honing it really into place. And that's where we sort of the early stages of back and forth details, and then the polishing is where we really are very collaborative.
So, okay, you've got this. You have a short film to start. I just want to touch on the short film. Now, did you have a plan in mind? I didn't get to see the whole thing. Like I said, I always saw clips of it, so everybody knows. Just because I wanted to see if the locations were the same and the actors were the same. So did you have a length for your short script, or can you tell me roughly where it ended? Like, did they get out of the train station? It's really what I'm going to ask.
This is something interesting that we kind of looked a lot at when we were doing the feature film, because the Perfect Strangers, the short, is 26 minutes long. And it's a structure, and it very much plays like a feature film would do. And that's a lot of the reasons that we made the feature film, is because that was the feedback. Their entire journey, which was more, it was mainly focused on just the two lead characters. We actually go through that entire journey. Obviously, all the other film and a lot of the scenarios aren't there, and a lot of what they go through obviously is a lot more condensed, because you're very much aware you've got to get on with it, so you can't really linger and absorb some of the scenarios that you really want to. So, but you know, it was a complete package story within its own sort of remit, worked really well. So when we looked at the feature film, it wasn't a plan, it wasn't intentional. It was just because people kept saying, are you ever going to, and we were looking for something to try and make on a low budget, because we tried to do a couple of, it was supposed to be a proof of concept in terms of the genre setting for a much larger film, which we haven't managed to pull off yet. So the necessity of trying to get something made, that was the obvious one that we knew that we could do on a minimal budget. So when we looked at it when we looked at the short film, we went, well, really they're on the same journey. It's about, you know, it's about the details, and it's about expanding the world in which this all happened. So we did take our rule book very much for the short film. It's like, okay, that's where it starts. That's where it ends. So we know the journey where we've got to get to, but it's all about how we got there. And we had a lot more room to play with it in the feature, which was nice. And obviously, we end up developing the themes of the film and into all these other secondary characters to give it a much, a bit more of a rich texture and a bit more of a scale, really.
Okay, so when you're remaking your short into a feature, are you using the same train station? Because the shots I saw, it looked like, yes, you were at the same exact place.
Rule was, if it's not broke, don't fix it. So, yeah, we use the same train station. We use the same hotel. Although, in the short, you only see that hotel from the outside and the reception scene. Right. The rest of it was all shot in a different location, which was hellish, which was not didn't really match, but we got away with it. That was kind of it. We wanted to use some other locations from the short, but they were more weather dependent, so we had to kind of shift our plans slightly, because, you know, it's like when you're trying to find snow in Scotland, it's like chasing the tornado in Twister. So no one's going to land.
I know you shot this in the winter. It's pretty evident. There's enough snow. They don't have snow in Scotland all winter long?
No, it's a very tricky thing. I mean, it seems to be every other year. So sometimes you will get a complete whiteout in all over Scotland. Other years, up in high areas like Glencoe, where we did film and where the ski resorts are, the Cairngorms, you will get snow at certain heights. But depending if it's a warm or a cold winter, will dictate how far it comes. And that year, it wasn't great. So had some challenges. So there was some days where most of it is in camera. A lot of it was prop snow. A lot of the falling snow is, you know, our our art department off camera with handfuls of it, you know, trickling it in, that kind of thing. I've had to dress some of the roofs and things with the machine. But yeah, so there's a wee bit of that. But I mean, we got, but all the mountaintops had it. And the scene where they abandon the car and they start having an argument, we had to go looking for that. And it was literally, I got up at like 5:30 in the morning, went out with the first assistant director and the owner of the hotel. And we went out looking for the best patch of snow because it was really unpredictable because it would fall overnight. And then you know you've got a certain amount of time before it melts. So we went out looking for it, and we had the whole crew standing by, ready to be given satellite coordinates of where to turn up when we found it. And we found it in this big car park at the top of the Rannoch Moors. It's like, okay, everybody get here now. So we just had to kind of sit and wait for the trucks to turn up. And then we started filming this, and it was all covered in snow. But as the day was progressing, it was starting to melt around the actors. So we ended up having to put some of the props, you know, just around them in the car. And then in post-production, the visual effect guys had to kind of paint in the rest of the ground because it would just melt over the, through the course of the morning.
I had no idea. I really thought that was all snow.
Mm.
That was pretty good.
It looks great. I mean, there was one scene where Jen gets lost in the forest in a blizzard. And we actually started filming that in a forest a blizzard, and it was really quite, it was like the ideal conditions, but it got quite dangerous. I mean, we had like a camper van we were using as a makeup truck that got blown across the car park where we were. The wind was so strong and the trees were starting to come out of the ground, so we kind of shot our wide shots and then went, right, we're going to abandon this and come back. When we come back, there was no snow at all, so we had to film all the close-ups, and our visual effects team had to just do and completely from scratch.
Wow.
I mean, I think some people think, oh, you've added some snow to that scene, haven't you? I went, no, we've added all the snow to that scene. That scene, when that was shot, that forest was green and brown.
Wow. Okay. Can we go back to a little bit of casting?
Yeah, yeah.
Because you kind of play a little game with people. If you've seen the short film, you change an actor. So the original actor obviously was available to come back. The original, yes. Male actor. Now, my question is about the female actor. Now, I did watch a little thing where she said she retired from acting, I read. Is that why she didn't come back for the feature? Or she just couldn't make it?
It was that. It was a bunch of different things. And we were kind of, we did this, I mean, the short was done in 2014, right? And about a year after that, she was nominated for a BAFTA for her performance, which was amazing. And then it's very tricky over here. And her career didn't, she kind of, when you're an actor over here, you have a go, you try and get in, and then you give your, most sensible people give themselves a certain amount of time, and then they kind of go, all right, well, I gave it a shot. And Claire was one of these unfortunate people who had kind of given up by the time the short came along. So kind of got briefly re-energized with the short doing really well and thought it might progress, and then it didn't. And she kind of just gave up entirely at that point. So when you make a low budget feature, you've got to be really careful, because you're throwing everything you've got in one basket. And I know we've got some celebrities in there, but the two leads were going to be unknowns. We knew that was going to be the case. So we had to make sure that, we had two actors who were hungry for it, because you put everything into all the PR and everything to sort of, it's got to be about them. And if someone's kind of already dabbled with it and has given up, then it wasn't necessarily going to be the best idea going forward. And we actually, the two of us actually spoke about it in great detail before we made the decision on what we were going to do. But she is in there. She is in there.
I know where she is.
We kind of had some fun with it. We actually wanted her in a different part. But Claire fell pregnant and was moving back from London to Scotland around at the same time I was. So it kind of clashed with the filming. So we couldn't physically get her to set, but we had this whole scheme to bring her in secret and not tell Natalie, who plays the new Jen, that she was going to be there. So she was meant to knock on the door, and the wee boy opens the door, and then the mum comes to the door, and it was going to be Claire. And we weren't going to tell Natalie, so she'd turn up
see it.
And Natalie's such the consummate professional that she would have... She wouldn't have caught. She would have carried through. She would have killed the pair of us afterwards, but it would have been really funny to get that shock reaction. And that was our plan. I mean, Claire and I were planning this for months, but we just couldn't pull it off.
I got to tell you a funny thing. So after learning about the short, I looked up the actress that played the wife. So I go, that's got to be her. So I really thought that was the original actress. I'm like, that's the only place she could have been.
Yeah, totally.
So then I looked up, like, oh, is that who she was? Because I had no idea, but I agree with you. That was where I expected her to show up. Because yeah, I did look it up.
It was like the perfect place for the cameo. And yeah, that was the plan. And, you know, obviously when we realized it was quite last minute, we realized we weren't going to be able to do it. So then, of course, we had to scramble about and go, oh my God, we haven't cast this part yet. And it's like, so luckily, Giga Gray, who stepped in last minute and played that part, did an amazing job. But yeah, it's just the things you plan that don't always would have been fun, but would it have improved the film? I don't, you know, who knows. But again, we kind of managed to sneak her in post production. Voice only. But yeah, that was funny. I came around to her flat and just said, right, do you want to just be this person? It's like, it's okay. Let's have some fun with it. And we just kind of spent a couple hours just sort of improvising all sorts of different things, which was really fun.
Okay, let's start at the beginning of the film. You mentioned you love Christmas markets, and guess what? There's a Christmas market in your film for some odd reason.
Yeah, how about that? So it was tricky trying to organize to film a Christmas market in January. So it was a wee bit tricky, but it was kind of fun to do. David Bickerstaff, who played the Glühwein Santa, or Grumpy Santa as we call him, was loads of fun. He's a friend who is trying to get into acting, and he kind of messaged me, said, is there anything in there for me? And I said, oh, Christ, there's nothing. And I kind of just jokingly said, well, how's your accent? Because we hadn't cast that part yet. I thought, he's never going to have a German accent. And he goes, give me some lines. So I sent him the scene, and he self-taped himself, and he sent it back to us. What do you think of this? And I went, oh God, here we go. And I thought, this is going to be cringy. I'm going to have to tell him this sucks. And then I clicked play, and it was amazing. I was like, wow. And I said it to Dave Newman, my producing partner. I said, am I completely mad, or is this brilliant? And he looked at it and went, yeah, he's got to be. It's going to be him. That's just genius. And it was great fun. That whole joke at the end, at the very end, he walks away and it turns out he's just been messing with them, and someone else comes in and he's like, oh, how's your mom? And goes all Scottish. That was a last minute improvisation on the day. It's like, we're just kind of try this. And we're just kind of, it was pretty cool. But again, somebody just gave of it, and we managed to get a choir in, and we made them sing the Scottish version of Silent Night, which is slightly again, it's a slight translation on the song we all know.
So when you're working on an indie film, I don't know if you've done mainstream productions or not, like I'm talking big ones, is it more fun to improvise, or do you get upset being the writer that they're off script?
No, I don't mind that at all. It's, you always want, the thing about indie films is you never have enough time to play with things as much as you would like, because it very quickly becomes about coverage and, you know, getting it in the can in the time you've got. My DP always says, you know, if, you know, get it done in the most economical way possible, and somewhere try and keep a bit of art in there. and it's great when you end up with a cast of actors who are free thinking and don't just, you know, stick to the text, and they won't. So when they want to kind of play with it and add things, but when you end up with a cast that have a lot of comedy background, they tend to offer up things because they've got that bug. They help themselves. I mean, there's a scene in the film, and it was a good scene, and it wasn't a standout scene in the script, but it was a good scene. And it was a very sort of little moment where you've got the single father talking about the sort of the pains of being a single father, estranged from his daughter, etc. And it's a really nice scene. It's really well played. And of course, you get everyone else in the background of this scene start having ideas. What if? So Sanjeev Kohli, who plays the hotel owner, was not actually in the script. He's not in that scene. And Sylvester McCoy comes up to me on that day and says, right, what do you think of this? What if we put Sanjeev in there and we do a bit of this, a bit of business here? And I was like, all right, cool. And then we kind of said, Sanjeev, because it was his day off and he was reading the book in the corner of the set. And it's like, do you want to be in this scene? And I went, right. And then we sort of hollered over the hotel owner and said, right, bring me a desk with every utensil or service equipment that you have, maintenance equipment that you have, from tiny to ridiculous. And he laid on this table with from a wrench to a hammer to a plunger to a miner's helmet and light. You know, it was just these ridiculous things. It's like, Sanjeev, go at it. And they improvised this little, you know, who puts an orange down a toilet type gag.
Okay, I do want to discuss that scene. Since you're going to bring up McCoy, I will get into McCoy. So that whole scene was improvised, and he makes the joke that he put the orange down the toilet so he could get free drinks.
Yeah, because in the script, it's a great moment. It's like taking what's there and just making more of it. Because in the script, we had the whole thing where he did go around and nick the whiskey and pour everyone a glass. That was in the script, but the kind of... We had the little extra carrot of, you know, the motivation. Well, I've sent him off, now I'm going to go do it. You know, so it's always like this whole because they established quite early on that, you know, Frank and Ernie have this sort of running gag with Sid, the owner, where they just like to mess with each other, and it's about who can do the next biggest gag. Because you've got that whole thing with the bet at the beginning and stuff. So they've got this whole repartee going on, which is great. So it was really just a sort of natural progression of that relationship. But again, you've got three really talented actors who bought right into what they're there for. And once they're in sync with it, they start bringing more to the table. And that's what you hope actors of that caliber will do. They'll bring more to you.
So how is working with Sylvester McCoy? I mean, he is a name. I mean, I know you need a name for your independent film. Mm. It does help. But he looks like a character. He looks like he's having so much fun during this film. I think you could have asked him to do anything and he would have done it.
I think you're right. I mean, Sylvester, what looks like he's having an absolute ball on screen, and that is exactly what he is having, an absolute ball. He didn't want to leave at the end. He was kind of having to be dragged away from the set. Very down to earth. Was it Kelly Boyle always says, I don't think Sylvester realizes he's famous. Because he's so sort of just ordinary, the way he speaks to you, and doesn't think he's done anything incredible and stuff. And it was like, I was in this movie called The Hobbit once. And it was like, yeah, we've heard of it. So it was just kind of very unassuming. I'm an absolute gent. I've got a lot of time for Sylvester. We'd be doing like press and stuff for it, and he'd kind of like on Zoom, and then he'd call me up in about 30 seconds later, goes, was that all right? And I was like, yeah, that was fine. And I thought I was a bit flat. No, you were great. I was like, cool, I just want to make sure I'm giving you what you need. He's like, yeah, totally. So he's very collaborative and very, unassuming is definitely the way I would describe Sylvester.
Let's go back to your lead, Jane. Did you have make her sing for the audition, or that was just all prep? Was she nervous, or can she really sing?
It was Natalie is a very old friend of mine, and so I'm very much aware of what she's capable of. So I like to push her a bit because she always rises to the challenge. So I was aware that she messed about with guitars and whatnot. I'd never heard her sing. I was just aware of it. So I just kind of said to her, I was like, listen, you dabble, don't you? If I put a song in this script, am I completely nuts? And we, you know, we talked about it quite a bit, and she said, okay, yeah, I can probably do it. And yeah, so yeah, she spent a lot of time with Stephen Wright, our composer, just rehearsing it, because before we shot the film, they'd gone into the studio and produced stuff, fully, you know, produced a single of this piece, even though she was to do it on set, because I said, I don't want her being dubbed. I don't want that being lip synced, because just you can tell when something's produced in the studio. It's just a bit too sweet. And I said, no, it needs to be a bit rough, ready. The character needs to be as nervous and as terrified as the actor most definitely is in this scene. And I want to feel that emotion. So if it's not 100% perfect tonally, that's fine, because that's what's going on. So we kind of pushed very hard for that to be done on set, and use the audio that was recorded on set. Yeah, I think she would have preferred that we hadn't done that, but I think the film was better for it. And it was definitely a tense day, because she was very nervous about it. I think she's used to, I think she's confident singing privately in front of an audience, and especially an audience of, you know, a handful of very well-known and experienced actors, including a pop singer. It was probably quite a terrifying experience.
Who's the pop singer?
Claire Grogan's the pop singer.
The young girl?
No, Claire Grogan, who played Anna.
The one that cooks the dinner, then?
The one that cooks the dinner. She is the she was an 80s pop star, and she still is. Altered Images was the band.
I apologize.
It was a big deal. It was a big deal over here. Huge deal over here. it was kind of one of these strange sort of two careers that kind of took off at the same time. So in amongst, you know, her big breakout film was Gregory's Girl. And at the same time is when the kind of the pop career sort of blew up. So they kind of happened in parallel. I'm not sure one had anything to do with the other, bizarrely. It's kind of it's slightly before my time, I'll admit. but, you know, over here it's a big deal. Claire is one of Scotland's national treasures.
So you stuffed your film then with celebrities, 80s pop stars, a Doctor Who alumni.
Two companions.
Look at you. Yes, I did notice that. Look at that. Stuff it away. So I don't really know what to ask questions about that. I'm just making fun. I do want to ask, whose car did you borrow to do those scenes?
That was a story and a half. Well, the original plan, it was Stephen Wright, who's our exec producer and composer, is a massive Bond fan and has his own 1980s Lotus Turbo Esprit in white. And the bloody thing was always on the blink. It's now working. You know, 2 years after we finished, it's finally working. I drove it up here the other day. But that was the plan. And we were aware a month before it was having some problems. It had some smoke coming out the back. We were assured it was going to be fixed in time. And then, you know, the day before he's scheduled to drive it up to set, the shell is in Glasgow. The engine is in Manchester. It's not happening. He's like, great. So basically, When you own a classic car like that, you're in all these different clubs and everybody knows each other. So he basically called round, and he had a mate who had this old Marcus, who he convinced to loan us it for the film, which was we were very grateful of. And it was a much better decision anyway, because it's a really cool looking car. It's blue, a really strong color. So if we'd shot the Lotus with all these aerial shots going through snowy Glencoe, you wouldn't have seen the bloody thing. We just disappeared into the background. So you've got this really strong sort of blue classic car standing right out and amongst all the snow, which looked great. So the only problem is, when you've got a classic car like that and you've got a lead actress who has to drive it, who's only just passed her test, which is what happened on both the short and the feature. It was one thing getting Claire to drive my Mini, but then getting Natalie to drive this old Marcus was not going to happen. So she took it for a test drive, and I think Stephen had heart failure. they both came back and went, "We're going to need to rethink this." So I went, "Okay." So that became an issue of, okay, so we kind of towed it in one shot, and then we green screened.
I was wondering if that was a tow shot.
It's such a hard thing to get right. I mean, I spent years trying to figure it out, and nothing ever completely works. The toy thing is tricky because we didn't plan for it, and we're in the middle of nowhere, so we had to get the local garage to send the tow vehicle up. But unfortunately, it's one of these vehicles where it puts the front wheels in these sort of slats, and this
I know what you're talking about,
and it lifts it up to about 45 degrees and tows it. I said, well, that's not going to work because it's going to look like they're shooting off into orbit. Because all that you're going to see in the background of the shot with the camera on the bonnet is tarmac. So I was like, that doesn't work. So I had to get him to lower it as low as he could. But unfortunately, it's quite hilly, those roads. So every bump, the bottom of his rig would scrape off the ground. And there's this footage of them doing this scene in camera, and this sort of horrible sort of grinding noise. Suddenly, this sort of look of fear: are we about to die? They're convinced that, and I'm sitting in the cab of the truck that's towing them with, and I can't see because they're so far away. I can't get a monitor to pick them up. So I've got headphones on with the radio mic, so I can hear what's being said, and all I hear is this carnage going on of them screaming, this big scraping noise. I'm like, what's going on? So yeah, it was a mixture of that, and then we did the sides, the close-ups. We did that with green screen in the car park, which looks great. I was really chuffed.
It does.
The visual effects guys on this did a really good job on very subtle stuff. I mean, I remember one critic slagged us off for the scarf sequence, and they went, the filmmakers had a brief shot at using some CGI, but then realized that they weren't very good at it, so they just didn't bother. And the visual effects advisor emailed me and went, "Does this idiot know there's over 320 visual effects shots in this movie?" Thanks very much.
That's pretty funny. Okay. I'm going to be very delicate in my next question, but you'll understand what I'm talking about. We get to the end of a Christmas film, and we expect one thing.
Ah.
And we don't get it. I think I've been pretty delicate not to ruin something.
Yep.
That always your plan, to just give us a big slap at the end?
Well, it's not supposed to be a slap. And it's the same ending in the short film as well. The entire concept was about that. Was based on this idea of someone coming into your life at a point where they make a huge impact on your life, and then they leave. It's sort of this sort of fleeting encounter, and that's what it was about. It was about these people being finding a way with one another to move on and accept their grief and their loss, and then they can go off and start to come to terms with it, because they don't resolve their crisis. They accept the crisis and know they have to go back to the real world and figure it out. And that's the point where we leave them. So they are two people from two very different worlds. So back in the real world, it wouldn't really happen. There'd be a post-credit scene of them, or a sequel where they all fall out and break up in the first 10 minutes. So it was very intentional. It was meant to be a slightly more realistic take on the genre was what we were trying to do.
I agree with you 100%. I love your ending. I did not see that coming.
Good.
I quite liked it. I'm like, oh, something different. Now, did you frame that shot? Did you spend time to frame it? Because I really like that end shot.
Yes.
One of my favorite shots in the movie. I'm like, is he trying to do a Back to the Future shot here? Because I see the clock tower. I'm like, maybe.
No, it was that last sequence where they go to leave one another and they stop. And that last scene is my favorite scene in the movie. It's a brilliant scene. And it was, when you're doing, when you're making an indie film on a low budget with very little time, ultimately there are compromises. So you have to be very careful where you decide to make those compromises. And obviously one scene that was never going to be compromised in its creative approach was going to be the ending. So yeah, it was very, very deliberate, the way it's set up and the way it plays out. And yeah, we took a bit of time and we did run over on that day. Sorry, guys. But yeah, it was, we had to get it right. And we did have the whole debate about what kind of ending it should be. And it's like, and we didn't want to get into a situation where we would shoot our authentic ending and then a distributor would go, well, we want the cheesy, expectable ending. We want that. So what we did, we actually shot an alternate ending in the same scene, but it's like, it's just one extra, when they step out, they come back in and kiss.
Which I expected. I was waiting for that moment.
Well, we shot it just to prove to anyone who criticizes how much of a bad idea it was. And our DP was fully expecting me to cave and actually change the film and not tell him. And it's like, he was so, he just shaking his head when we were filming. He's like, it's sellouts. And yeah, we shot it, and we shot it seriously as well. I was like, you know, let's not take the piss. What would this look like? And it was like, yeah, it's a terrible idea. They did it really well.
Oh, like, I agree with everything you're saying, but I just expected something and ended like, all right, I'm getting the full pops for that. That's what I wanted. Something different.
Yeah, well, here's the thing. That does split the audience. Some people really love that. Some people really do not. I mean, I had one person who gave us a review. I think it was on Amazon or something. After they watched it, I went, I loved the first 90 minutes of this film, hated the last 10 minutes. One star.
Oh, no.
So like, you don't give it one star because you hate a tenth of it. You know, it's like, no.
Oh, he's got to appreciate. That is, I agree with you. That is my favorite shot of the movie. It's that last shot you do.
And the whole movie actually builds to it.
Yes.
It's got this grounded emotive quality to it all the way through that, although it does get fanciful and romanticized, it still kind of retains its realistic edge. And so in my mind, that isn't an ending out of left field. It should go straight towards it. I mean, I was actually listening to it earlier on, the score for this. The longest music cue in the whole film is the last one. And it starts the moment she finishes singing the song, and there's this feeling of ending, and there's a sort of somber approach. Although it's very emotive and it's very romantic, there is this sort of foreboding of the bubble is going to burst, which is what it's all heading to, and it's a seriously well composed piece of music. It's just like, it takes you on a journey, because there's very, in that whole section, there's very little dialogue, and it's just the performances and the music that is driving sort of the conclusion of the story of their journey together.
Okay, I think I've touched on everything, but one last thing before I get to fun questions, because I forgot. When you were finding a hotel room, did you pick the tiniest hotel room you could find in that inn to shoot in?
No. That was really tricky. Trying to find somewhere that was big enough for a camera crew, but also I wanted the window. I wanted the big window.
Oh, God.
I wanted their night together to be this sort of backdrop of this moonlit winter environment. And it was all meant to be very silhouette-y and whatnot. So I actually wanted a much bigger window, but we couldn't find one. And we talked about green screening and stuff, but I said, if you start putting effects and then something doesn't go 100% correct, then the eye is distracted from what's going on, and you lose the connection. So, it was tricky because, you know, the hotel had some bigger rooms, but not necessarily the window was in the right position. And there was various ones where we thought about maybe we'd move the bed it wasn't all that. It was quite tricky, and it actually just to completely kill the illusion. If you watch the first scene where they go into the bedroom early on in the film, you look very closely through at the entrance, because they walk through the hotel in this corridor and they go into what they think is a mm-hmm. door. If you look very close, you can see that room actually goes out to the outside.
Okay, because I thought it was a weird shot. Because I think you trick the audience by throwing that kid out. That kid coming up to interrupt our entrance into that area, we're not paying much attention to anything else. And then you got to the room.
Yes, yeah, absolute sleight of hand going on there.
So, yes, I did notice. I'm like, that's a weird... Okay, well, I guess that'll come back later, which it does.
Yeah,
the kid comes back later, but that kind of threw me off. So I see what you've done. See, I was paying attention, but I'm like, what?
Yeah. Just, tricks of the trade, my friends.
Good work. Okay, I don't want to take up much more of your time. I think we've done a pretty good job of promoting. So I do have questions. We've already answered my first one, your favorite film. I do ask, you said Trains, Planes, Automobiles, so I've changed it. What's your favorite romantic film?
It's going to be The Proposal with Sandra Bullock and Ryan Reynolds.
Which is a wonderful film, which nobody ever actually watches, because that's Ryan Reynolds not being Ryan Reynolds.
Exactly. It's a really well-managed film. It's really well-performed, really well-shot. It takes itself slightly seriously, but not too seriously as well. It's got a great balance to it, and you do not see very many romantic comedies that well-balanced anymore, which I think is a tragedy.
Well, since your film is about Christmas, we have to discuss your favorite Christmas film.
The Polar Express.
Oh, you and my daughter would get along immensely. That's her favorite. Every year I have to watch The Polar Express.
Yeah.
Now, you're older. You've gotten a lot of presents over the year. What's your favorite present you've ever gotten?
Oh, I did not see that question coming. You have to give me a second, yeah?
I got to ask different ones all the time.
Favorite present. Do you know what? It's probably going to be my PlayStation 4.
Which is nothing wrong. I will give you that 100%.
I wish I had something more ethereal and a bit more cerebral
for you.
But yeah. That was my first Christmas present from my now wife. We weren't married at that point, but so it was very early on in our relationship. But it's like, oh, she must be serious. She's bought me a PS4.
Perfect. Before we let you go, do you have a website to promote? Anything you would like to promote? We know your film's available on Amazon Prime. What else would you like to give us?
Yeah, well, we're all over social media. So we're Facebook, Twitter, Instagram. Very keen to engage with everyone, spread the message. And again, I like to have conversation. You know, it's like, if people want to talk about the ending, let's talk about the ending. Hit us up on social media. Let's talk about it. Because, you know, some people will get it. Some people might have just missed something, so they didn't quite see it. So they end up getting annoyed about it. So it's kind of, yeah, totally. Yeah, I love to know what people think and have that sort of... There's nothing better than when you go to a film screening. Like when you go to... Back in the day when we could easily go to a physical screening, and you all get together in the bar afterwards and you have this big conversation and debate about everyone's interpretation of it, which is the bit I love more than sitting through the film.
I think we all do.
Yeah. Come and talk to us.
Thank you for your time and have a great night.
And you. It's been an absolute pleasure.